There's a lot we can learn from the life of Gideon regarding spiritual pitfalls. Jeff taught the first of the three lessons on Gideon, and he presented and described Gideon as a man who doubted that God could use him to deliver Israel from the oppression of the Midianites. Last week I spoke about Gideon, and I described him as a man who, though afraid, trusted the Lord, and the Lord used him to deliver Israel. Today we're going to study chapter 8, and we're going to see that Gideon is an enigma. And I'm not necessarily going to be as kind to him as you might think. Today we're going to study chapter 8, the first section of that chapter, because it can be easily divided into two sections. The first section is verses 1 through 21, and this is a section that tells us about Gideon's activities after the victory over the Midianites. And then the second section consists of verses 22 through 35, and I've entitled that section From Fame to Folly, The Decline of Gideon. You know, sometimes with success, there comes along with it a moral choice. And how we respond to that moral choice may determine whether we progress in our Christian lives or whether we become entangled in things that are detrimental to our progress. Well, since the NFL draft was just a few days ago, I've still got football on my mind. If you followed the Dallas Cowboys over the years, you probably have an opinion about the team under Tom Landry and the team under his successor, we'll call him. At the height of his career, Michael Irvin was known as the playmaker. And there's a good reason for that. He was a wide receiver during what one might say were the glory days of the Dallas Cowboys. Michael was the 11th pick in the first round of the 1988 NFL draft. Those were the days when Tex Sham was the general manager, Gil Brandt was director of personnel, and the coach was none other than Tom Landry. During his first year with the team, the Dallas Cowboys' win-loss record was 1-15. Sounds kind of like Cleveland, doesn't it? For you non-football fans, that means they won one game that year. And to add insult to injury, Michael Irvin tore a ligament in his right knee, and he only played six games in 1989. During the 1990 season, things began to improve, and names like Troy Aikman and Emmitt Smith and Michael Irvin became household words, not just in Dallas, not just in Texas, but around the country, because the Dallas Cowboys were America's team. Michael's best year was 1995. He set franchise records that year for receptions, 111, and for yards gained by a wide receiver, 1,603 yards. Over his eight-year career with the Dallas Cowboys, Michael Irvin gained 10,265 yards, made four straight appearances in the NFC Championship game, and won three Super Bowls. Unfortunately, Michael Irvin's personal life was a mess. Now, there's no need to rehash the details other than to say that Michael had a problem with cocaine. Now, I'm not bringing this up in any way to besmirch the reputation of Michael Irvin, because I think by all indications he faced up and confronted these issues, and they're all things that are now in the past. Besides, everything I'm about to say was on television, so it's not private. You know, forgiveness is a wonderful thing for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is forgiveness means that we do not have to be defined by our past. So this is not a shot at Michael. I bring this up because I recall an interview that I saw with Michael on television that has stuck with me over the years. It was probably 15 years ago, and I can't forget it. He was speaking about his issue with cocaine, and he said something that has just stuck with me over the years. He said, "You know, when I was down, when things were bad, when nothing was going my way, I didn't have a problem with cocaine. I only had a problem with cocaine when everything was going great, when I was on top of the world. And then he said it was in times of success, when everything should have been easy, that's when I would fall. I remember as a kid there was a television program called The Millionaire, back when $1 million was actually a lot of money. It aired from 1955 to 1960. Just as the story was, an eccentric millionaire would give $1 million anonymously to a regular, normal, everyday, unsuspecting guy. And then the plot of the show would be to follow how that sudden wealth affected his life, either for good or for ill. In most cases, it didn't bring the happiness and security that one would think great wealth would provide, and in many cases, it ruined the life of the recipient. Now, I usually avoid sports analogies because for some reason, I just don't like them. But for the last 2 weeks now, about all I've talked about in the introduction to my lessons are sports. And today, it's been the Dallas Cowboys and Michael Irvin. And now I'm about to mention another sports analogy that has to do with track and field. Normally, when we run a race that's competitive in nature, perhaps as a member of the track team, usually we try to pick the race for which we think we are best suited, a race that we think we can run and perform well. Races tend to fall somewhere between the 40-yard dash on one hand and the marathon on the other. And in between these two extremes, you have the 220, the 440, the 880, the mile run, and usually a runner will train either for speed or for distance. Rarely do you find someone who trains for both. Now, there are some marathon runners who are fast. I will never forget watching the New York Marathon one morning and watching Alberto Salazar run the 17th mile of the 26.2-mile race in 4 minutes and 17 seconds. And the 17th mile in New York is when you start going uphill. So there are people who are exceptionally talented, and yet you typically don't find marathon runners who can compete with a sprinter in a 40-yard dash, and you're not going to find a sprinter who can sprint for 26.2 miles. It's just not going to happen. Well, this metaphor of a race is used in Scripture to describe the Christian life. In Hebrews, we read, "Let us run with endurance the race that sets before us." The race sounds like a marathon because a marathon is an endurance event, and the Scriptures encourage us to run with endurance. But sometimes life throws us a curve, and the race may seem more like an obstacle course. It may have impediments that we have to jump along the way, or something we have to go around that was unexpected. An obstruction comes in our path. And then there are even times when it seems we may be running the gauntlet just to get through a day. There's a drill used by football teams that was that's called the Oklahoma Drill, naturally. It's called the Oklahoma Drill because it was developed in Norman, Oklahoma by the storied coach of the Oklahoma Sooners, Bud Wilkinson. And basically the way the Oklahoma Drill works is all the team lines up in two lines opposite of one another with about 3 feet between the two lines. And starting down at one end, one of the players will run down through this alleyway, if you want to think of it that way, while the whole team, two at a time, tries to completely knock the person's lights out. And John Stevenson, who played running back at Rice, is smiling because I think you may be thinking back on a time or two when you ran that drill. Well, it seems like Gideon, in particular, had to face certain challenges that mirrored just every kind of difficulty a man can face in the course of his life. He had to fight, or at least he thought he was going to have to fight, the armies of the Midianites. In the beginning, he was leading 32,000 men, so he had to have a certain amount of people skills. That would have been a necessity. We're not told this, but I'm sure Gideon had to exercise tact and wisdom when he explained to his 300 men that they were going to go down and defeat three armies camped below them in the Valley of Jezreel. So we see Gideon exercising wisdom at the beginning of the chapter we're going to look at today, chapter 8. The chapter opens with the remnant of the Midianite armies on the run. The battle proper is over. The Lord could have destroyed all the people in the Midianite army with or without the involvement of Gideon. He could have turned all the swords of Gideon against each other and completely taken care of this problem. But the fact that he allowed Gideon and his men to participate was an act of grace. It was an act of grace because it allowed them to understand on a personal level how the Lord fights for his people. Now, what's going to happen when we begin reading these verses is the tribe of Benjamin has joined Gideon to pursue the few people who survived the battle. I ended last Sunday's lesson with a quote from L.R. Klein, and I'd like to repeat it this morning as a transition from chapter 7 to today's lesson. The quotation is from L.R. Klein's book, Triumph and Irony, where she writes of Gideon, "The coward becomes confident. He directs far-flung mopping-up operations, which are effectively carried out. But the voice of the Lord is stilled, not to be heard for the balance of Gideon's narrative. And the spirit of the Lord, which brought the courage to fight a far greater military force, seems to slip from Gideon's shoulders." It's not a very encouraging introduction to the last phase of Gideon's life. The reason I'm citing this is because I think perhaps Gideon had come to one of those crossroads, one of those times when he was forced to make moral choices. And the question is, did he make the right choice? Now, if you remember from last week, we know that the Lord reduced Gideon's fighting force from 32,000 men to 300. He did this to prevent Israel from becoming proud and thinking that they had defeated the Midianites by their own strength. With the 300, any chance of the battle being won by means of military force rather than by the supernatural intervention of God was gone. But now that big event's over, and there are new challenges that are presented to Gideon. Ephraim has joined in the pursuit of the Midianite remnant. Now, on the positive side of the ledger, we see Gideon acting wisely in terms of how he deals with a challenge that the Ephraimites put before him, and it's a more serious challenge than what you might think. So let's look at the first three verses of chapter 8. "Then the men of Ephraim said to Gideon, 'What is this thing you've done to us, not calling us, when you went out to fight against Midian?' And they contended with him vigorously. But he said to them, 'What have I done now in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? God has given the leaders of Midian, Oreb and Zeb, into your hands. And what was I able to do in comparison with you?' Then their anger toward him subsided when he said that." Well, Ephraim's complaint here is that Gideon didn't recruit them back in the beginning. You may recall from chapter 6 that his original call for the army was to the tribes of Manasseh, Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali. Ephraim was never involved at all. So they're upset. They're angered because they weren't involved in this great victory. So they're upset. And we see two phrases that are used here, which are a bit unusual. The two phrases are these: "What is this thing you have done to us?" And the next phrase is, "And they contended with Gideon." There's a Ugaritic scholar named L.B. Cutler, and he does an analysis of a document called the Ugaritic Baal Cycle. It's a religious text that's written in the cuneiform script. And he's found that these two phrases are used in conjunction with one another in Akkadian literature, in Biblical Hebrew, and in Ugaritic. So throughout the Middle East, these are two formulaic phrases, which we might not pick up on that. But these are formulaic phrases that are typically used together across the board in ancient Near Eastern literature. And when they are used together, what Cutler discovered is they form what is known as a battle challenge. In addition to this, the phrase "and they contended with Gideon vigorously" makes use of the term Reeve, R-I-B, Reeve, and it escalates this issue even further. If you were to look back at the 1984 NIV translation, you'd see that they translate this phrase and they criticized him sharply, but that's way too weak for what the Hebrew text says. The NIV correctly revised its translation in 2011 to read, and they challenged him vigorously, which is almost the same wording as both the 1977 and the 1995 NASB translations, but even that is too weak. If Reeve as a term is used in a legal context, it's used to refer to things like a divorce. It's also a word we saw first back in chapter 6, verse 32, where it was translated, "Let Baal contend or fight against him." So chapter 8 begins with a very serious schism between Gideon and the Ephraimites. And it's worse than you might think from just casually reading through the text. So with this in mind, Gideon's careful to select his words wisely. As you know, the book of Proverbs had not yet been written. But Gideon seems to capture the wisdom that later will be inscribed there using these words. A gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. The tongue of the wise makes knowledge acceptable, but the mouth of fools spouts folly. Nevertheless, the question still looms. Had God revoked his previous command to limit Gideon's fighting force to 300 men, or was it still in effect? Now that's an important question, because here he is again at the end of verse of chapter 7 recruiting the Ephraimites to go participate in these mop-up operations, and yet we don't know from the text whether God's initial command, I'm going to do this with 300 men, has been revoked. If it has, we're not told. I didn't see Gideon inquiring of the Lord. I didn't see any indication that the Lord had communicated new instructions to him. Chapter 7, verse 23 and following just records Gideon summoning troops. I don't know. There's a lot about this chapter that you have to kind of make some assumptions about from context, and this is one of them. I'm not 100% sure of this, but it's a question we have to deal with. Klein's observation, the voice of the Lord seems stilled, and her comment, the spirit of the Lord seems to be slipping from the shoulders of Gideon, cause concern. And add to this the fact that as soon as Ephraim shows up in Gideon's camp, they do so with a battle challenge on their lips. And there's another thing that makes me think something has changed, and it's not necessarily something good. It seems to be that Gideon is acting independently of the Lord here. And you might say, well, why do you say that? Well, it has to do with the way the text itself is structured. Turn back a few chapters to the third chapter of Judges and look at verse 10. This is going to be in reference to Othniel. Verse 10 says, the Spirit of the Lord came upon him, that is upon Othniel, and he judged Israel. When he went out to war, the Lord gave Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Mesopotamia, into his hand, so that he prevailed over Cushan-Rishathaim. Israel rejected the Lord, and they worshipped the Baals. They got involved in idol worship, and God gave over Israel into the hands of Cushan-Rishathaim. He was a king from Mesopotamia. Under pressure from a foreign military power, Israel repented, and God raised up Othniel to deliver the people from the domination of Cushan-Rishathaim. Now, listen to this. Immediately after that is stated in the text, that Othniel delivered Israel, it's followed immediately by a summary statement in verse 11 in the very next verse that says, then the land had rest for 40 years. Now look, if you will, at verse 29, same chapter 3. They struck down at that time about 10,000 Moabites, all robust and valiant men, and no one escaped. So here again, we see Israel has done evil in the sight of the Lord. They have once again turned to idol worship. God then has engaged Israel through the instrument of the Moabite army under the command of Eglon, king of Moab. 18 years of oppression follow until Israel repents and God raises up another judge, Ehud, who leads Israel to victory, and they defeat the enemy by striking down 10,000 Moabite soldiers. And just as we saw a moment ago, exactly the same as with the delivery of Othniel, a summary statement appears immediately in verse 30. So Moab was subdued, and that day under the hand of Israel, the land was undisturbed for 80 years. Skip over to verse chapter 5, verse 31. This is the end of Deborah's psalm. The very end of that chapter, she says, and the land was undisturbed for 40 years. So in all these cases, there has been a pattern of deliverance that is followed immediately by a summary statement declaring the period of time in which the land resulted in a time of peace because of God's actions on the part of Israel. And here's what I want you to understand. This is formulaic. There are a lot of formulas that you'll see in Semitic documents. It's formulaic, and in Semitic literature, you don't change the formula unless you have a reason. So someone who's used to reading this type of literature in a pattern, if you will, suddenly comes to chapter 8 and something has changed there, and it's not something that necessarily is good. We should expect the first verse after the end of this battle that Gideon conducted to read something like, and there was X number of years of peace in the land. But the summary statement that follows the battle is down in verse 28. So 27 verses intervene between the end of the battle and the summary statement, and you have to ask why. It seems there may be two reasons: the nature of the Ephraimite tribe itself and the character flaws in Gideon, and we'll focus primarily on that second one. Ephraim was the prima donna tribe. They were second in importance, perhaps only to Judah. Ephraim could claim Joshua as a famous person among their family. And Shiloh and Bethel, two important Old Testament sites, were located in the land allocated to Ephraim. When the news of this great victory spread among the Israelites, Ephraim then, recruited by Gideon for the final work of destroying the enemy, poses a challenge. Gideon's wisdom is on display in the way he responds to the Ephraimite challenge through a proverb. It's interesting how he answers Ephraim. First, he poses a rhetorical question that minimizes his own role in comparison with Ephraimites. He says, "What have I done in comparison with you?" Then he throws a little flattery at them with a second rhetorical question: "Is not the gleaning of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer?" Well, Abiezer is the clan to which Gideon belongs, and the vintage of Abiezer would be the best that Abiezer can produce. If you look at verse 11 of chapter 6, it says, "Then the angel of the Lord came and sat under the oak that was in Ophrah," that is Gideon's hometown, "which belonged to Joash the Abiezrite. And his son Gideon was beating out the wheat in the wine press in order to save it from the Midianites." So he is saying that my heritage, my background, the best that we can produce is less than the crumbs that come from Ephraim. It's a way of exalting Ephraim over himself. Then he points out that God has already rewarded Ephraim. He's allowed them to capture Oreb and Zeb, two commanders of the Midianites. So we're seeing some aspects of success here in this mopping up operation, which kind of argues against whether Gideon was right or wrong. It seems that whether he was right or whether he was wrong in recruiting Ephraim, God is essentially using Ephraim to capture his enemies. Nonetheless, he plays down his role and he says, "What have I been able to do as compared to what you have been able to do?" Why is this important? Well, because we learned something about Gideon. We learned that Gideon probably belonged in the State Department rather than in the Defense Department. He's a better diplomat than he is a general. I think, in fact, God chose him If you think about the whole contest of paring down the army from 32,000 to 300, he's not going after strength, he's going after weakness. So Gideon was probably not a very good general, but he was a reasonably good diplomat. At the end of verse 3, we see how this diplomacy turned out. Then their anger toward him subsided when he said that. Now let's start again now at verse 7 over in chapter 8. I'm sorry, verse 4 of chapter 8. Then Gideon and the 300 men who were with him came to the Jordan and crossed over, weary, yet pursuing. He said to the men of Succoth, to the people who were following me, please give loaves of bread for the people who are following me, for they're weary, and I'm pursuing Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian. The leaders of Succoth said, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hands that we should give bread to your army? Gideon said, okay. When the Lord has given Zeba and Zalmunna into my hands, then I'll thrash your bodies with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. He went up from there to Penuel, and he spoke similarly to them, and the men of Penuel answered him just as the men of Succoth had answered. So he spoke also to the men of Penuel, saying, when I return, surely I will tear down this tower. So, as if Ephraim's challenge weren't enough, Gideon now gets a double dose of resistance from these two towns, Succoth and Penuel. These two towns are located on the east side of the Jordan River. They both have significance historically to Jacob. Penuel is the place where Jacob wrestled with the angel before he met Esau, and he didn't know at that point whether the meeting with Esau was going to be dangerous or good, or whether it was going to be bad. But this happened at Penuel after he had departed from Laban. God blessed him there, even in face of this potential problem with Esau. And then Succoth is where Jacob settled after he met and then departed from Esau. But despite the history of these places, the inhabitants who are living there are living in unbelief. The resistance Gideon meets is a passive resistance. It's a simple failure to act. The men refused to give support to Gideon by withholding bread from the troops, even after Gideon explained that they were tracking these two kings of Midian. It's obvious to me that the men of Succoth and Penuel were resisting out of fear. You know, it's human nature. Everyone likes a winner. And these city officials were not confident Gideon was going to be the winner at the end of the day. And if they had given aid to Gideon and his men, and if he had failed to capture these two kings, it was pretty obvious what was going to happen. They were going to come back, the two kings of Midian, and they were going to exact a high price against the people of the city for helping Gideon. Well, the men of Succoth answered Gideon's request for support with a question. Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hands that we should give bread to your army? This is a subtle and cowardly way of saying no bread for you. So the issue here is less that the men of Succoth don't think well of Gideon. Their sin is one of unbelief. Unbelief in God and unbelief in his word. Unbelief is the beginning point of sin. If you didn't believe the chair you're sitting in this morning were going to remain upright during class, you would have picked a different chair or skipped class. This morning when it came time to drive to the church, if you didn't think your car would perform reliably, you would not have set out on your journey. Or one of your kids would have called Uber for you, maybe. Because what we believe matters. What we believe matters. And I think there is a sequence, there is a relationship in thinking, thinking being the basis for believing. There is a relationship between thinking, feeling, and acting, and the sequence of those things cannot be violated without consequence. Let me explain. What you believe ultimately will determine how you feel. And how you feel will ultimately determine how you act. And you can't fool around with that sequence. If you focus solely on how you act, that is, on things you do or don't do, you'll become a legalist. After all, isn't legalism an obsession with do's and don'ts. If you focus first and foremost on how you feel, then your daily walk with God will be governed by your circumstances, how you're feeling at the moment. Much apostasy is rooted in emotionalism. But if your beginning point is what you believe, how you think about the truth of God's word, then ultimately that belief will determine how you feel, and that feeling will govern your choices and your actions. The men of Succoth should have known that God had given Gideon and his small band of men victory. That should have led them to have faith, that is, to believe that God would continue to bless Gideon in his pursuit of the Midianites. And that being the case, they should have given aid to Gideon in complete confidence that they were doing the right thing. Belief, feeling, and acting. That is the way God designed us. But all men are born unbelievers under the weight of Adam's sin. And in that state, they will not believe the word of God because, according to 1 Corinthians 2, they cannot believe it apart from the Holy Spirit. Jesus explained this to his disciples in the 16th chapter of John. He was announcing the coming of the Holy Spirit and the benefits that are going to come to believers because of the Holy Spirit. And in verses 8 and 9, he says, "The Holy Spirit will convict the world of sin and righteousness and judgment concerning sin because they do not believe in me." Belief is the starting point of sin. Succoth and Penuel did not believe the word of God. Well, their negative response is then followed by a threat from Gideon. "When the Lord gives these two kings into my hand, I'll be back, and I'll thrash your bodies." Literally, the Hebrew text says, "I'll trample your flesh with briars." He leaves the village. He continues on. He comes to Penuel. He makes the same request, where he gets the same exact answer again. Now, verse 10. "Now, Ziba and Zalmunna were in Kakor, and their armies were with them, about 15,000 men, all who were left of the entire army of the sons of the east, for the fallen were 120,000 swordsmen. Gideon went up by the way of those who lived in tents on the east side of Nobah, Jogbeah, and attacked the camp when the camp was unsuspecting. And when Ziba and Zalmunna fled, he pursued them and captured the two kings of Midian, Ziba and Zalmunna, and routed the whole army." So he continues east. There he captures the two kings, and he destroyed what was left of their army, which was about 15,000 men. And this gives you a pretty good idea of the magnitude of the original challenge, because we read here that 120,000 are dead and 15,000 are running to the east, which means that that initial group upon which they looked in the valley was 135,000 soldiers. Yes?
How big is Gideon's force at this point?
Well, see, that's the question. When he finished the question is, how big is Gideon's force right now? Well, he's got the 300 men with him, because none of those were killed. But he's got some people from Ephraim who have joined him, and we're not told how many. There's some fuzzy math, not fuzzy math, but there's some fuzzy areas in this text that we're just simply not told the answers to some of these questions. Verse 13.
Excuse me.
Yes,
why
ma'am.
Why do you think that was?
I'm sorry?
Why do you think that was? That they didn't want to give them
information? They were afraid. They didn't know who was going to prevail. And the men of the city were afraid that if they gave support to Gideon and Gideon was defeated, that those people he was fighting against would come back and kill them because they had helped Gideon. It would have been a way of taking sides.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Verse 13. "Then Gideon, the son of Joash, returned to the battle by the ascent of Heres. And he captured a youth from Succoth and questioned him. Then the youth wrote down for him the princes of Succoth and its elders, 77 men. He came to the men of Succoth and he said, 'Behold, Ziba and Zalmunna, concerning whom you taunted me, by saying, are the hands of Ziba and Zalmunna already in your hand, meaning have you defeated them, that we should give bread to your men who are weary? He took the elders of the city and thorns of the wilderness and briars, and he disciplined the men of Succoth with them. He tore down the tower of Penuel and killed the men of the city. Well, after the battle, Gideon returns back by the way of something called the Ascent of Heres. No one knows exactly what that is. Heres is an alternate, albeit uncommon, word meaning sun. It's not the normal word for sun, S-U-N, in Hebrew, but it is an alternate term. And it should read, instead of by the ascent of Heres, from the ascent of Heres. So if I were forward to guess, I would bet there's an upward slope when you're traveling west to east, east being the direction from which the sun rises, which may be why this was named this. Gideon is then descending down this this terrain, traveling west toward the two towns who had refused aid. He captures a young man from Succoth, and he asks him a question. We're not told the question, but I have a pretty good idea what it was. I think he asked him, who is the mayor and who sits on the city council? Well, the boy was civic-minded because he was able to name all of these people. He was literate because he was able to write down their names for Gideon. And so he gives Gideon the information that he's asking. Gideon took the men in the wilderness, and it says in my translation, he disciplined them there. The Hebrew text literally reads, he caused the men of Succoth to know, which is an interesting way to say this. He educated them, pointed out the mistake they'd made, and informed them of what they should have done. Penuel received the same judgment at the hand of Gideon. Verse 17 simply says, he tore down the tower and he killed the men of the city. You know, Jesus once said, whoever wishes to save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. And this is exactly what we're seeing playing out in these two cities. The men of Succoth and Penuel made what they thought was a safe decision, but it was a decision that led to their demise, which is the nature of men to hold on to things in this world. But I would remind you that the world and the things that are in the world are perishing, and Penuel and Succoth are tangible examples of how this principle will be applied when God calls the world to judgment. Verse 18. Then he said to Ziba and Zalmunna, what kind of men were they whom you killed at Tabor? And they said, they were like you, each one resembling the son of a king. Then he said, those were my brothers, the sons of my mother, meaning that means a full brother. As the Lord lives, if only you had let them live, I wouldn't kill you. So he said to Jether, his firstborn, arise and kill them. But the youth did not draw his sword, for he was afraid because he was a youth. Then Ziba and Zalmunna said, rise up yourself and fall on us, for as the man, so is his strength. So Gideon arose and he killed Ziba and Zalmunna, and he took the crescent ornaments which were on their camels' necks. After the event at the two cities, these verses address a more personal matter, the murder of Gideon's brother. Now, it's interesting, there's a really odd term that's used there. Some of your translations may say, where are the men you killed? Which is kind of an odd question to ask. And it's also not the question that they answer. The proper translation probably should be something along the lines of, what is the nature of the men? What were they like, those men that you killed? What was their nature? Because that's the question these men answer. They say, they were like the son of the king, like you. So they're not answering the question where, they're answering the question, what were these people like? So this goes on, and this is more of an accusation to justify for Gideon what he's about to do than it is an attempt to find out the information. I'm convinced he already knows. The Midianite kings try to flatter him, but they're not as good at it as Gideon was. They reply, well, they're like you, like the sons of the king. They don't say like the sons of a king. They say like the sons of the king, which means probably Joash. They're probably referring to the father of Gideon, not that he held that as an official title. But we're going to start to see some things about kingship that are going to begin creeping into the text, and they're going to come in full force next week when Jeff teaches the next chapter. So there's this idea of kingship. It's possible God may have used this atrocity, that is the murder of Gideon's brothers, as an initial motivation for Gideon's call back in chapter 6 to go fight the Midianites. Now, we're not told that, but that's possible. So this event, the murder of his brothers, happened before the battle. Well, if you notice in verse 20, Gideon's son is present. Now, I seriously doubt that he was with Gideon at the battle. I seriously doubt that he joined the Ephraimites in pursuit of the Midianites after the battle was won. So I think what happened here is Gideon captured these two kings. In effect, he handcuffed them, if you will, whatever the equivalent was. And he took them back home to Ophrah to execute them in the presence of his family. This is why I suggested Gideon's question about the men the kings killed may have been a motive, for original motive, for fighting the Midianites. God motivates people as he sees fit. Well, this becomes not Gideon's best hour. He's not acting any longer in the national interests of the nation. He's settling a personal score. And what's worse, he tries to persuade his son to perform the executions. He's a youth. The Hebrew word is na'ar. It usually refers to a boy between the age of 14 and 21. He could very well be on the young side of that age spread. He probably was a teenager. He can't bring himself to kill these men, so Gideon slays them in his presence, and I'm sure in the presence of his entire family. Then this section closes with Gideon doing something interesting. Gideon takes what are called the crescent ornaments from the necks of their camels as trophies. But there may be more to it than that. There may be more to this than just taking spoils of war, because these crescent ornaments were emblematic of kingship. So once again, we're beginning to subtly see this concept of kingship come in. They would have been similar to the presidential seal that's always present when the president speaks. We'll take another look at that at the end of the lesson. Verse 22. Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, "Rule over us, both you and your son, also your son's son, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian." But Gideon said to them, "I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you." So, who among us doesn't wish our practice of our faith and our theology were equal? I wish my actions were as good as my theology. I'm sure you do too. When in Romans 7, Paul laments this chasm between what he desires to be as a follower of Christ and what he actually does in practice, this is the dilemma he faces. Gideon is suffering from the same malady as Paul, and in fact we all do, because we all have old sin natures. In verses 22 and 23, the people, I think primarily out of gratitude for what he has done to Midian, ask Gideon to establish dynastic rule over them. I refer to a dynasty because they say, "You rule over us, and your son, and your son's son." That's a hereditary regime. That's what you call a dynasty. Now, it's subtle. They don't actually say milak, which is how you would say be a king. They say mishal, rule over us. In other words, perform the function of a king, but we're stopping short of suggesting that we make you an actual king. But in reality, there's very little difference in the two. In verse 23, Gideon refuses their request, at least on the surface. He says, "I will not rule over you, nor shall my sons, Yahweh, shall rule over you." Now that really sounds good. Sounds like You're tempted at this point to think, well, Gideon's got his head in the right spot. He understands that Israel is a theocracy, that Yahweh is the monarch, if you will. He is the head of the theocracy, and he does not want to be the one who transitions Israel from a theocracy to a monarchy. But was this a de facto clear refusal, or was it a veiled acceptance? That's the question I want you to think about. I know what he said. But if you examine the life of Gideon after this, he behaved in some ways exactly like a king. Think about this. He had 70 sons, and according to verse 30, which we'll read in a minute, he maintained a harem, very much like a king. We know he had a concubine in Shechem, and the son of the concubine bore for Gideon, he named Abimelech. Does anyone know what Abimelech means? My father is the king. Avi, my father. Melech, the king. Now, Gideon may have rejected the outright transformation of Israel from a theocracy to a monarchy, but he kind of liked this idea of living like a king. I also think that taking these crescent ornaments, he took them off the camels that the kings were riding. I think they played a role in this, perhaps even being the catalyst that stood behind the offer the people made for him to rule. And with kingship, whether it's declared or implied, there come temptations which the less powerful did not have to contend, and it's hard to argue here that Gideon is not on a downward spiral. Verse 24. Yet Gideon said to them, I would request of you that each of you give me an earring from his spoil. For they had gold earrings because they were Ishmaelites. And they said, we will surely give them. So they spread out a garment, and every one of them threw an earring there from his spoil. The weight of the gold of the earrings was 1,700 shekels of gold, besides the crescent ornaments and the pendants and purple robes. Sounds kingly, huh? Purple robes, which were on the kings of Midian, and besides the neck bands that were on their camels' necks. Gideon made it into an ephod, and he placed it in his city of Ophrah, and all Israel played the harlot with it there, so that it became a snare to Gideon and his household. So Midian was subdued before the sons of Israel, and they did not lift up their heads anymore. And the land was undisturbed for 40 years, in the days of Gideon. There's your summary statement that we expected to see back earlier. He says, I'm not going to be a king. Yahweh's going to rule over you yet. Notice that? Yet or but. That's a conjunction of contrast. A conjunction of contrast sets something that's being said now up against or in contrast with something that was said before. What was said before was, no, I will not be your king. What is being said now is, but I'd like to have the royal treasury, so give me your gold. I'd like to wear the purple robes that the kings had. And oh, by the way, I'd like to have those kingly ornaments that were on their camels. But I don't want to be your king. 1,700 shekels of gold is 43 pounds. I didn't bother to try to figure out what that is at today's exchange rate, but that's a lot of money. I can't remember if I said this or if I'm supposed to say it later, and I don't want to forget to say it, so I'm just, if I come to it later, I'm going to skip it. This Abimelech, his son, by the concubine, my father is the king. There are three other people in the Old Testament named Abimelech, and they're all Philistines. I'm convinced Abimelech is not a proper name like Gideon or David or Abraham. Abimelech is a dynastic title. So they say, rule over us. He says, no, Yahweh will rule over you. But I want all these kingly things. And then he has a son and he names the son, my father is the king. And he uses a particular phrase from the Philistines That means the head of a dynasty. You see what's going on? Previous verses aren't looking good for Gideon. Now let's look at verse 29. Then Jerubbaal, the son of Joash, that's Gideon, went and lived in his own house. Now, Gideon had 70 sons who were his direct descendants, for he had many wives. There's the harem. His concubine, who was in Shechem, so he has them scattered out around the nation. His concubine, who was in Shechem, also bore him a son, and he named him Avimelech. My father is the king. And Gideon, the son of Joash, died at a ripe old age, and he was buried in the tomb of his father Joash in Ophrah, the Abizarites. So the previous verses don't look good for Gideon. They record his actions immediately after the victory over Midian. Now, in these verses we just read, they describe his conduct during the 40 years of peace that followed that victory. The choices he made during this final phase of his life, or of the campaign, are setting the tone for the final period of his life. He ruled the people as Jerubbaal from his own house. This may seem innocuous to us, but in the ancient Near East, sons lived in their father's house. Gideon has moved away. He's ruling the people, perhaps not from a palace, but certainly away from his family. And as I mentioned earlier, he's established a harem. He's fathered 70 sons, the text says, for he had many wives. And here's where I was supposed to tell you that Abimelech is a dynastic title, not a proper name, so I'll remind you of that again. Verse 33. Then it came about as soon as Gideon was dead that the sons of Israel again played the harlot with the Baals, and they made Baal-berith their god. Thus the sons of Israel did not remember the Lord their God, who had delivered them from the hands of all their enemies on every side, nor did they show kindness to the household of Gideon in accordance with all the good that he had done to Israel. So there's, again, part of the enigma. It closes this chapter by referring to the good that he did. So it's a mixture. He is an enigma wrapped in conundrum. That's the best way I know how to describe it. Faithfulness didn't survive beyond the death of Gideon. As soon as he was dead, the people turned again to idolatry, and they make Baal-berith their god. Now, of all things, Baal-berith means Lord of the Covenant. It's hard not to see a terrible irony here as Israel turns from the covenant Yahweh made with Israel to a pagan deity whose very name mocks the covenant relationship that the nation has with Yahweh. So I have a couple of concluding remarks because I know it's 11 o'clock and I'll be quick. I mentioned earlier that 27 verses appear between the end of the battle proper and the summary statement of verse 28. The enemy was subdued, the land was undisturbed for 40 years in the days of Gideon. And there were two reasons we gave for this. One is the nature of the prima donna Ephraimite tribe, and the other are character flaws in the person of Gideon. We've seen both of these. Mainly, we focused on Gideon. Gideon started his decline as soon as the battle proper ended, and he began pursuing those two kings. He called in Ephraim without any record that God told him to do so. He failed to correct the people when they credited him for the defeat of Midian. They're essentially crediting him with the victory when they offer him the kingship. He acknowledged, at least verbally, the sovereignty of God, yet his actions indicate his words were at best platitudes. And it concerns me that back in verse 3, though I didn't mention this, Gideon refers to God as Elohim rather than Yahweh, God's covenant name. His statement almost parallels that of the Midianite soldier in chapter 7, verse 14. And it probably wouldn't be more than a curiosity to me if it weren't for all these other things, but it's just one more thing. Gideon is acting like a typical Oriental king, not like a man of God. He's treating his countrymen badly. His actions are driven by a personal agenda, not by a nationalist agenda. He reacts to the death of his brothers as a king would react, as assassinations that require blood vengeance. And he took for himself the symbols of royalty from the kings of Midian. Daniel Block wrote in his commentary, "The offer of kingship to Gideon simply sought to formalize de jure what already was de facto." I think that pretty well sums it up. I don't think there is any doubt that it was the victory over Midian that led to this offer of kingship to Gideon. And what should have been a humbled Gideon over time became a source of pride and personal gain. Why didn't he correct the people when they credited the victory to him? If ever there was a battle in the history of Israel that the army couldn't take credit for, it was this one. But Gideon remained silent. Why didn't he say, "I won't be the king over you because I didn't do anything"? He defers to Yahweh, sort of, in verse 23, but then he continues the downward spiral, indicating he was mouthing the right words but not taking them to heart. And there's no indication anywhere of a divine call from God to call Ephraim, or certainly not to rule over the people. But no one seems to care. It's almost as though they haven't even thought about it. So I'm going to close by pointing out four quick things about this story. Throughout the book of Judges, we're going to see that to the extent that anything good happens in the lives of God's people, it's solely because God's grace, because God has chosen to make it so. God's moved to have compassion on his people when they're in distress, but not because of merit. Even the leaders, God's instruments for delivering Israel, are flawed. Second, when God acts in grace on behalf of any nation, and in particular of Israel, no enemy is invincible. But by the same token, no nation in disobedience can escape God's discipline. The third point is this: the greatest obstacle, if that word can be used at all in terms of the Lord's work, is the faithlessness of God's people. Even after experiencing this miraculous victory, the people quickly turn to apostasy and idol worship. And finally, those called to leadership are especially vulnerable to temptation, the temptation of personal ambition, the temptation to substitute a personal agenda for God's agenda is a constant temptation, and it must be confronted daily with prayer and submission to God and his word. So that is the end of that chapter, and next week Jeff is going to talk to us about Abimelech.